this week's Know Them From Adam podcast, we'll be joined by the voice of the Minnesota Vikings, Paul Allen, who on KFAN had the call that we've heard over and over and will continue to hear over and over for years to come. And then we'll be joined by Dick Vermeil, who once made the same transition that John Gruden did, going from the broadcasting booth to the sidelines, back to coaching. It's exactly what John Gruden has done, and we'll talk to Dick Vermeil about his perspective about how Gruden will fare in his next move as the Oakland Raiders head coach. We'll also speak to Evan Kaplan, the NFL researcher, who has a preview of this weekend's conference championship game and some news and information and numbers that are very important to these matchups, and we'll do the Ask Adam questions. But first, Paul Allen of KFAN. Paul.
Is it okay to call you Shefty, even though I've really never met you?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Man, it's my honor to join you there, whether it's via podcast, radio, TV, tweets, whatever, man.
Well, it's my honor to get you in a week like this. This has got to be one of the single biggest, most significant weeks of your career. Am I correct in that thinking?
Yeah, I mean, when we went to the NFC title game in 2009, it was off a victory over the Dallas Cowboys that was pretty convincing. And you know, when the polarizing figure for your team is Brett Favre, that is going to command a lot of the attention.
Yeah.
This is different in that this is a younger team that has a lot of really good players, but not any really, you know, massive huge names. And obviously, off the way they beat New Orleans, with the Minneapolis miracle and then the way it transpired at the end, we certainly are garnering a lot of attention around here.
And Paul, on that note of the Minneapolis miracle, I have this for us and the listeners to check out.
Three receivers right, field, and left. Marshawn Lattimore, 12 yards from Adam. Case on a deep drop, steps up in the pocket. He'll fire to the right side. Caught by Diggs.
Stay
on!
Oh my God!
30!
No!
10!
Touchdown!
Are you kidding me? It's a Minneapolis miracle! Stephon Diggs and the Minnesota Vikings have walked off on the New Orleans Saints. It's a 61-yard Minneapolis miracle.
And that call is courtesy, of course, of KFAN. And Paul, I want to ask you first, have you heard that call since you made it on Sunday?
Yeah, I've heard it. We play it back on KFAN, where I have a 9 to noon central radio show, and I had heard it that evening. It kind of blew up a little bit on Twitter, and you know, there was a fan in a suite next to me who took a video of me making eye contact with Vikings assistant coaches in the box right next to, as I call it, the Vox box. And you know, I've known these coaches for years, yeah, including quarterbacks coach Kevin Stefanski. I've known him for more than 10 years. And when we made eye contact and they started pointing at me and fist pumping and banging on the glass, I just went nuts and just started pumping my fist. And it was a very surreal moment, Adam.
When you hear that call, are you pleased with it?
Yeah, I'm pleased. Yeah, I would say. I mean, you don't really, you know, you can't really script how something like that's going to happen. The analyst Pete Bursich is generally more even keeled than he was in that situation.
Right.
But that he went out of body the way he did, I feel, you know, really amplifies the moment. I mean, I don't want to get too play-by-play technical here, but, you know, there were some people who were like, Mr. Analyst, get out of the way of the play-by-play guy, let him do his thing, then come in and analyze. And I'm completely on the other side. I mean, when we're calling Vikings games, specifically me, I'm not Syracuse trained. I mean, my highest level of education was junior college, and this is the only play-by-play job I've had at any level. So I am a compensated fan who was lucky enough to audition for a job in 2002 and win it. And that's what you're going to get from the Vikings Radio Network broadcast. We call it like fans.
And when you hear that call, what was going through your mind on that play? Take me through it as best as you can.
It's very difficult to explain. And, I mean, I've called 300-some-odd games. And we've had some big spots, you know, over the years. Like, you know, Blair Walsh missed that playoff field goal in 2015. In 2009, Favre across the body, picked off by Tracy Porter. In 2003, Josh McCown and Nathan Poole bounced us out of the postseason.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, there have been some big moments, but with that, there was a moment where I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I mean, I just couldn't believe at that moment when I saw the safety run into the corner, and knowing the probably the prudent thing to do was for Diggs to get out of bounds and give Forbath an opportunity to kick a long field goal and win it. When the analysts started freaking out, I just watched Stephon run, you know, 30, 20, 10, and then he disappears in the tunnel, and I start looking around the field for flags, and I can't find any, and I'm like, oh, my God, I can't believe we just won the game the way we did.
See, that was my reaction. See, I had a series of reactions, like, oh, wow, they completed the pass. Oh, wow, he's going to be able to get out of bounds. Oh, wow, he's running downfield. Oh, wow, there's nobody there. Oh, wow, he's going to score and they're going to win. And each one of those things was more improbable than the next.
Well, and from a broadcasting standpoint, for the first time in my career, you know, and at U.S. Bank Stadium, we have the fans right in front of us. Like, you know, when I'm at Soldier Field, it's a very low-level broadcasting vantage point. The fans are right up on you. Same thing with New England and some other places, Foxborough. You know, but these fans were so rabid, and they were so excited. And in, you know, in being here for nearly 20 years and doing Vikings games for 16 years, they could sense how excited I and we were.
Yeah.
There were fans trying to climb into the broadcast booth off their chairs so they could high five and hug us. And the spotter, in essence, had to act as security so we could complete the moment and make sure we did it right.
So this is going to be a dumb question. That was easily the biggest call of your career, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's as of now, it's the, you know, I've done a radio show here on KFAN since 98, been a racetrack announcer here since 95, and done Vikings football since 02. In 2009, you know, when Favre went across the body to Tracy Porter, that's one I'll never forget in the NFC title game. Earlier that year, week three, Favre found a wide receiver named Greg Lewis back right of the end zone to complete an improbable comeback against San Francisco and move us to 3-0. But that what happened with that Minneapolis miracle, that is the single biggest highlight of my professional career at any level. And the moment still resonates now. You know, just when we talk about it, I think back to it, and it's just electric.
What has been the biggest fallout so far of it? I know it's only a few days old here, but has there been one result that is surprised you of all this?
You mean the game or the call?
The call. The call. How it has impacted you.
The weirdest thing, and you haven't done it, but you're elite at what you do, is I've had TV stations come into the radio station and a lot of requests from TV stations who have wanted to ask me, like, what my mindset was when I said Minneapolis Miracle. Mm-hmm. It's just weird to hear that, man. I mean, you know, I don't script stuff for ends of games. It's like when, you know, when I'm calling a Vikings game, specifically a playoff game, I will script some scene setters. So like some stuff on New Orleans, stuff on Vikings in the postseason, stuff on Drew Brees, stuff on the Vikings elite defense. And I'll put those on cards so I can get them in early in the game when I'm setting things up.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the latter stages of the game, you know, you just got to let it happen. And you know, before the Vikings started that possession, after Will Lutz hit from 43, I said to the analyst, we're going to need a Minneapolis miracle. And Bursich, the analyst, responded by saying, this is the spot where legends are made. And we don't script any of that. You know, we've done the job together for 11 years, and we play off each other, I feel, very well. And then my recall was just to unfurl that. And that's how it worked. But, I think the strangest thing is just doing TV interviews about a call in a game where really Keenum and Diggs and Pat Shurmur and Marcus Williams and Ken Crawley and everybody involved in the play, they mean more to this than me.
Can you imagine what it would be like in that stadium? You mentioned the fans crawling up into the radio booth and your spotter having to act as a security guard. Can you imagine what your stadium and booth would be like if the Vikings were able to...
I'm a little concerned about this weekend, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm not, you know, when you get to the championship games and the Super Bowl, Westwood One-related terrorism creeps in. So, you know, I don't exactly know where I'm going to be in this game. If it's the regular spot, then I'm right next to Merrill Reese, broadcasting Immortality, and Mike Quick. And I do remember, because we did a game at Lincoln Financial last year, the fans are right on you. And, you know, I remember in regular season games, or we had a postseason game there after the 04 season, these fans don't mess around. But, you know, and I don't come there wearing neutral colors, man. I got my Vikings Radio Network coat. I got my purple shirt and my purple tie. And let's go. I mean, I'm certainly not going to trash talk fans specifically in that building and have them throw things at me. But, you know, when the adversary makes big plays, the home crowd has a tendency to get quiet. So they will definitely hear me, and hopefully we don't have any problems.
So Paul Allen is coming to Philadelphia, and how do you think your team is going to fare there on Sunday night?
You know what, Adam? I think it's going to be a very low-scoring game. I mean, I've watched back the TV copy of Eagles-Falcons, and I've done a lot of All-22 work on the Eagles at this stage of the week. And, you know, I know Fletcher Cox and Brandon Graham and Vinnie Curry and Malcolm Jenkins. I know they're good players, but really until you deep dive on them and you see what they do with 55 Brandon Graham and where they put him in nickel situations and what Fletcher Cox does when he's singled up against a center, it's imposing. I mean, they're front seven, with all due respect to Carolina, Atlanta, and some other teams we've seen this year. It's absolutely the best I've seen. It's fast. It's tough. Now you got Foles against Zimmer. I think that's a fair narrative into the game. Nick is not having a lot of success when he tries to throw it down the field. Mm-hmm. They ran a screen to Jay Ajayi in the Falcons game that was just a work of art, and they're very good at stuff like that. So Vikings absolutely have a chance to win. I think it's a very 50-50 game. Feels very low scoring.
You actually study film, getting ready for a broadcast like this, Paul, huh? I don't think there are too many play-by-play men that do that, I would bet.
I do it every week. I do it strictly to, because the, you know, I've done this job so long here, and I've gotten so close with Mike Zimmer and his staff, that they afford me the opportunity to watch practice and be around the facility a lot. So therefore, certainly never would say that I'm part of the coaching staff or the team. But you know, I really like to know what the coaches think is going to happen. So I kind of know coming at me, here's what they think is going to happen. So I can now have the background on that for when I call the game. And you know, when I talk to Pat Shurmur, the offensive coordinator, George Edwards, defensive coordinator, or some of these coaches with whom I'm friends, I like to chat with them with educated opinions and educated takes, as opposed to being like, Fletcher Cox, boy, he's good. Now, I like to say Fletcher Cox lines up over the right guard a fair amount, but when they go nickel, he goes over to the left guard. Why? You know, because then it just takes you more, it takes you deeper into the game, and I guess I'm snobbish that way.
Well, let me say this. I do believe this, that local radio men like yourself, particularly people who are passionate like you, which is not always the case, but local radio men, I think, are some of the most knowledgeable people about those teams and those local markets of anybody that there is.
Well, you should be that way, especially like me, if you're doing a radio show on the flagship 5 days a week where, I'll have conversations with coaches and players after games. And, you know, you're certainly not going to throw anybody under the proverbial bus. But if things don't go well, you want to share the right answer and you want to do it in a way that's fair to the team and appeases the fans. So I really love it. I love the nuance of game planning. I love the nuance of watching plays back and forth. Like, we had a punt block for the first time this year in the New Orleans game. You know, Sunday night, I wanted to figure out whose fault it was, just so I knew in case it came up during the course of the week. And I really enjoy that part of it.
Now, you mentioned that you had not done broadcasting before, and you've now called over 300 Vikings games. So how did you get into this job? How do you land this Vikings play-by-play job for KFAN?
Well, I'm a racetrack announcer by trade, you know, and I think I've called horse races since 1993, started in San Francisco, got a job in the Twin Cities in 95 at a racetrack called Canterbury Park. And, you know, I did the racetrack gypsy tour around the country for 5 years. Then I landed a job at KFAN Radio in 98. And you know, I just put in a lot of tape equity where I just found places at Metrodome to call games into tape. And do a little work for Vikings.com with something called the Cybercast. And, you know, when the job opened in 2001, I auditioned for it and I got beat, but they weren't happy with the guy they used. So, you know, they wanted to use me in 02. And it was just by the grace of God, I got the job. I was very raw and very wild early. kind of like that Minneapolis Miracle call you heard, but all the time. And, you know, I just refined my skills, held the job, and, you know, I love it, man. It's the only way to put it.
It comes back to that Malcolm Gladwell theory of somebody doing something for 10,000 hours. If anybody does something like that, they naturally get better and improve at it, right? So you've now done this for so long, you have to get good and refined at it, and you are great.
I mean, my key with things, because, you know, I didn't go to college. I went to Pasadena City College outside of Los Angeles for 5 years. And, you know, working at Pasadena City College and interning and working for the Pasadena Star News, covering horse racing and high school sports, you know, I traveled with the junior college drama team. I was editor-in-chief of the school newspaper, and I had an on-campus radio show. And, you know, to get these jobs without a college degree, I had to lowball everybody. So, like, when the racetrack thought of hiring me in 93, I'm like, well, what's it pay? And they said $250 a day. And I said, all right, I'll do it for $125 a day. And, you know, I just had to take roots to getting into these jobs that I would say those who get degrees from Syracuse don't.
Well, you know what? I think to get into this field, you don't go into this business for money. You don't do that. You should be willing to work for free at first. I know that sounds crazy. Go wait tables, go bartend on the side. That's what I was willing to do. And then eventually, if you do it long enough, hopefully there is some money to be made. But at first, you're not going to make money. So that approach of giving yourself 50 off to the employer, I love that. That's a great idea. Great advice.
Yeah, I'm not trying to turn this into a motivational seminar on the Adam Schefter podcast, but in this game, whether it's what you do and you're the best at what you do, or calling Vikings games, doing radio shows or whatever, it matters. It just matters getting in. And when you get in, you got to outwork everybody, and you got to take the circuitous route without disrespecting people to find a way to move up. It's very difficult. It's very tough, specifically in this day and age of social media. And you just got to believe in yourself, man, like you have, and look where you are now.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you. You got to make yourself indispensable, and that's what you've done. And I congratulate you on that. And listen, I think part of the joy this weekend, Paul, was that you mentioned so many calls and games and instances that have gone against the Vikings. So many, right? Like, you brought up, and I'm sorry to do this to you, you brought up the Brett Favre play, but we have that too right now. So let's take a listen to that.
Brett Favre goes back to pass. He pumps. Now he fires over the middle. Intercepted. I can't believe what I'm seeing right now. It was intercepted by Tracy Porter. Near side to the 40, and John Sullivan runs him down at the 47-yard line. You've got to be kidding me. I can't believe what I just saw.
Looking at that play, he should have just held on to it, Paul. He should have. He could have easily gotten 5 or 6 yards if he would have just pulled that thing down and dove forward.
But why do you even ponder passing? I mean, you can take a knee and try a 56-yard field goal. This is not Detroit, man. This is the Super Bowl.
And so there we have it. We have Brett Favre. We have Blair Walsh. We have Gary Anderson. And that's why Case Keenum to Stephon Diggs, the Minneapolis Miracle, that's why it meant so much to you, that organization and that city, because you cannot appreciate a moment like that unless you've been through all the heartache that Minnesota has.
Right. Isn't it weird, though, that after that moment, you feel like you should be hoisting the Lombardi? Instead, now you got to get ready for Brandon Graham and Nelson Agholor and Jay Ajayi and LeGarrette Blount. Are you kidding me? I mean, these Eagles are so good and so fundamentally sound in so many different areas that it's fair to add into the conversation, Adam. And I know Mike Zimmer is going to do a wonderful job with it because I chatted with him about it yesterday and he squared away. Off that moment, you got to tear these kids down, and then you got to start practicing, and you got to build them up the right way. You got to go on the road, make sure the ticket clomp distraction is something that is not palpable, and then you got to play an evening game, which is the season's penultimate game. So it's such a tricky endeavor, and I can't wait to see how the head coach navigates it.
I know you don't even want to think about this. Regardless of win or lose, what is Minnesota going to be like as a host city for the Super Bowl, whether the Vikings are in it or not? And I guess that would change it one way or another either way, but I'm just curious to know how your city's going to hold up during the Super Bowl.
It's going to be unbelievable. No, you know, I'm maybe it's because I'm secure with my masculine femininity, but I love Mall of America. It's one of my favorite places in the world, and that's where Radio Row is going to be. So I think people will enjoy that. They've been building a lot of things, Adam, and just doing a lot of things around the stadium for quite some time now. Hopefully the weather comes up okay, and the Skyway system's fantastic. And, you know, Minnesota, Minneapolis, and St. Paul have a lot of things to do. There are Timberwolves games that are going to be taking place, Wild games. I think people will really enjoy it.
I want to go to a Timberwolves game, but I'm also a big food guy, Paul. So if there's one restaurant that I want to eat at in Minneapolis that week, what is the one place that I have to go to?
I got to be careful here because I don't want to ruin my comp. And your podcast is incredibly popular. So I'm going to do it this way, Mr. Schefter.
Yes.
The best steakhouse in Minneapolis is called Manny's.
Yes.
It's spectacular. Maybe you've even been there.
Yes, I have.
Now, my favorite restaurant in Minneapolis, you know, I'm from Washington, D.C. I grew up on what they call soul food.
Yep.
Is called Revival Fried Chicken. And it's in South Minneapolis. And they serve Southern food, and I absolutely love it. So remember Revival Fried Chicken along with Manny's. And if you happen to be at the facility at Winter Park in Eden Prairie, there's a steakhouse by us called Wildfire. That's incredibly good.
Well, those are three great suggestions. And, Paul, I want to thank you for the time today. You did a great job on Sunday. It's fun to hear so much happiness and passion coming from your voice. A great nickname, the Minneapolis Miracle. I like Mini Miracle because it's shorter, but Minneapolis Miracle on the spot is very impressive to me, and I congratulate you and thank you for taking the time today, Paul.
It was absolutely my honor coming on your podcast. Now, not only do I have all of your albums, I have all of your podcasts.
Well, I listen, thank you for listening. Thank you for listening, and thank you for being a guest.
Bye-bye.
And that was the voice of the Minnesota Vikings, Paul Allen. We'll be back in a moment with former broadcaster and NFL head coach, Dick Vermeil. Coach, how are you?
I'm doing okay for an old man, Adam.
What is Coach Vermeil doing these days with himself? What takes up most of your time?
I'm in the wine business, requires a lot of time.
Yep.
And I allowed some friends of mine to put some money in a hobby of making wine that I'd been doing for years because I, you know, born and raised in the Napa Valley and having been connected with the wine world all my life, they talked me into taking my hobby and turn it into a business in 2008. So now I have to work at it.
And what has been the most challenging part of the wine business to you, Coach?
Well, convincing the wine world that someone out of the athletic world can actually be involved with an organization that can produce quality wines other than just putting your name on it to sell it because so-called celebrity status.
Yep.
That's, you have to overcome that because a lot of people have done that, you know, and that people don't believe your wines are that good until they taste them. And the hardest thing is to get it in the hands of the people that like good wines. So, and we're making strides, yeah.
Has it been what you thought it was going to that business?
Like I said, it wasn't my idea, but I would say it's a little tougher to make the playoffs than it is in the NFL.
Is it really?
Well, you know, there's over 500 wine labels in the Napa Valley alone, let alone Sonoma County and the rest of the state. And Adam, small, low production quality wines making 2,500 cases of wine a year cannot make inexpensive wine.
Yeah.
They have to make great wine and sell it at a price that can at least break even. And we've been in the business 8 years, and we haven't broken even yet.
Wow.
You know, it takes time because for everything you have in the barrel, you've got 2 years behind it. You know, you do a new vintage, you got 2 years in the barrel behind it with the same expenses. So there's always expenses, and you have to get to the point where when your wines become available for sale, especially your high-quality wines, they get sold. Hmm. Otherwise, you develop a backup log, and they're hard to get rid of.
You know, there are a lot of people that seem to go from the NFL world into the world of wines. Am I imagining that or not? You, Drew Bledsoe?
Yeah.
Having some people from the 49ers organization, I don't know, Carmen Policy or Eddie DeBarlo, some.
Oh, yeah. Carmen Policy and I have the same winemaker.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was born and raised in Calistoga in the Napa Valley.
The Calistoga
That's
Comet.
Where all my lifetime connections were. So, and I've been involved with a vineyard there all my life.
Yeah.
And my great grandfather owned 48 acres of it at one time, and now it's a 170 acre vineyard. But anyway, the great Woodson has a very good Cabernet called 29. Dan Marino, along with Damon Heward, have a wine called Passing Time. There's a number of people making very good wines that came out of the athletic world. There's some NBA basketball guys doing it.
How has the weather, Coach, in California this year, the fire specifically, impacted the business?
Well, you know, we are fortunate. I live in Pennsylvania, and I only spend maybe a month a year in the Napa Valley. But the fire got within a quarter mile where we custom crush our wines and make them. At a winery called Tambor Bay, B-E-Y. And it got within a quarter mile. And that's scary. You know, that's scary. But we were very fortunate. The fire went on over into Sonoma County and did much more damage than it did in the Napa Valley.
Now, one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on, Coach, is because, obviously, John Gruden has come back to coaching. And he's gone from the broadcasting booth where he spent 9 years back to coaching at the age of 54. Now, you, after the 1982 NFL season, resigned to go into broadcasting with CBS, later ABC, and you spent basically 15 years out
14,
of,
yeah, 14,
14
years.
Out of coaching before you got back to it. What was that like for you, and what do you think is in store for John Gruden?
Well, I know what it was like for me, and similar to John, I was fortunate that I was able to stay in the game with no pressure involved as a broadcaster, and that was super for me. You know, I had only planned to stay in broadcasting a year or two, and then I'd go back. And at that time, Adam, I went from making $75,000 a year coaching the Eagles to $150,000 a year broadcasting.
Okay. Wow.
In 1 year, I doubled my salary by getting out of coaching. Now, that's not the reason I got out of coaching, you know. But anyway, in those days, they didn't pay coaches. Coaches are almost a necessary evil, you know. But, you know, it's a different world as we know today. So, anyway, I stayed in broadcasting longer because I wasn't convinced I wouldn't find myself in the same hole I found myself when I felt I had to leave it for a while, you know. John didn't leave coaching because he was burnt out. He left, number one, because he got fired, okay.
Yep.
So there's a difference there. And I regretted staying out as long as I did, but I appreciated every minute of the opportunity ABC and CBS gave me to coach the game because it kept me deeply involved. Now, I'm not like a coach, but sometimes you see more from the outside than when you do when you're inside. Hmm. So I invested 14 years evaluating what everybody else was doing with the ball, how they played defense, how they organized their practice schedules, because I was on a different practice field all the time because I always went in early. I was allowed in coaches' meetings. I was allowed offensive coordinators' meetings. I was allowed in film studies because of mutual respect coming out of coaching. So I saw a lot of great coaches, and I left many times saying, boy, that guy's doing it better than I ever did it.
Wow.
And I also left a number of times saying, you know, the way I was doing it was better than the way they're doing it. So I learned a lot that way. And I also regained a balance in life a little bit, a little better balance.
Mm-hmm.
I left because I allowed a passion to become an obsession. See, I don't think John has done that. And I don't know anybody in coaching or out of coaching any more passionate about football than John Gruden. That's why I've been needling him for years to get his butt back in, okay?
You've told him that, to get back in?
I've stayed in touch with John all along, all through his broadcasting, okay? And I first met John Gruden when he was an intern coach at Tennessee years and years ago when I was invited to come in and be a guest speaker at a football clinic, and he was assigned to pick me up and take me to the airport and then bring me back to the airport the next day. Okay?
Wow!
So that's how long I've known him. I knew his dad who worked at the 49ers, so I have great respect and admiration for John. I know where he's coming from.
How do you think the transition will go for him now after being out of the game for 9 years? Because when you get back in, the players aren't the same as when you left the sport initially.
I say this, he'll come back in better than he left. He'll see more. Because he's evaluated, had a lot of free time to evaluate more. And I don't know anybody that studied the game any more than John has since he left. You know, I think he'll end up being a better head football coach. I think he'll see the big picture better. I think he'll recognize where his weaknesses and strengths were when he was doing it. He'll recognize what he has to do in terms of surrounding himself with people that can help him be as good as he has the ability to be. I think he'll be a better leader. I don't think there's any negatives in John going back. I really don't.
And the salary, Coach, you mentioned it yourself. 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I know it. You know something? I think it's about time. It's about time they pay a coach equivalent to a great player. You know, there's to my studies, there's 113 players making over $10 million a year, 13 of them making over $20 million a year. Now, why shouldn't a guy that controls how they play be as important?
Yeah.
I have never figured that out.
You actually have studies and charts?
Just Google it. You'll get it right off the online. I Googled it and studied it.
Well, you know what? Here's the thing. The hours that a coach puts in are off the charts, as you know, as you talked about a passion.
John, like me, magnifies that. You probably don't have to put in as many hours as we did or do, but that's us. I think that comes from maybe a slight insecurity that you just keep trying to find a way to do it better because you feel, no problem is ever solved forever.
You know, you talk about your passion becoming an obsession, and the great writer from Sports Illustrated, Gary Smith, wrote one of the most memorable profiles ever read about anybody, about you, with that passion becoming an obsession. And when you say that, that's the first thing I think of because he documented, basically, the burnout that came along for you as an NFL head coach.
Yeah, you know, I think, too, and I look back in my life. I'm 81 years old now, and I look back at it, and, a little bit of it, I think, was my own insecurity. You know, feeling comfortable amongst the big-timers, feeling that you belong there, that you can compete with these guys. You know, you come out of high school and junior college coaching, then into college coaching, and all of a sudden you line up on a game day and you look across the field, and there's Don Shula. There's Tom Landry. There's George Allen. There's Don Coryell. There's, you know, Bill Parcell. You know, not Parcell so much in that time because he was a young coach. But I was nervous around those guys. I never quite felt sure I belonged in that league, you know, because I held them in such high esteem, more so than I held myself at that same level. And I think that drove me into a hole. Huh. I felt a lot better when I went back.
What accounted for the change, Coach, over that time?
Maturity, understanding, evaluation. You know, the most important, and I say this to all young coaches, the most important person to improve every year in a football program is you, the head coach, as a coach and a leader. Then you go to your coaching staff and improve them. Then you go to your squad and improve them. But it all starts with you trying to get better yourself. Eliminate what you didn't do well. Admit it. Move on. Get somebody that can do that thing better than you could do it. But, you know, and I had been out so long, Adam, that I recognized I wasn't going to be able to come back like when I was at Philadelphia. I had 100% control of personnel. I ran my own offense. I was my own offensive coordinator. I called my own plays and all those. And when I'd been out 14 years, I recognized I could not come back in and do that. Once I got back in, the first year was, it takes you a while to get used to the hours again. Mm-hmm. What I recognized most probably, Adam, was from 82 to 97, there were more great big players in the league that can run and play than when I left. My largest man on my Super Bowl team was 275 pounds.
Wow. Wow.
I fined $25 a pound for every pound he was over it. Okay. Then you come back, and all these guys at first look so much better than they really were, but everybody was better. And the other thing you recognize is the value of what the gifted athlete can do. If you watch wide receivers today, every game you see an average receiver make a spectacular catch. You didn't see that in the old days. You know, you just didn't see that. The other thing was, Adam, it was far more volume of offense and defense Yeah, it was far more sophisticated game. When I left coaching in 82, we spent a lot more time with the individual within the scheme, making him a better fundamentally player individually and collectively fit within the execution of the scheme. Now they spend far more time on the schemes and the numbers and the volume of what you do and see every weekend is four times what you used to see. Remember Vince Lombardi? He had four or five running plays, okay? I don't know how many passes he had. But you knew they were going to run it, but they executed and could handle all the variables within that play that they could keep the ball moving. Well, that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
You know, within my last offense, we ran Al Saunders ran in Kansas City. We'd run stuff and not run it again for 4 weeks. So you understand.
You mentioned that every week you see a catch that you would never have seen back when you coached. And yet I think some people wonder if the game is as good today as it was in yesteryear. What is your assessment of where the game is at today?
Well, I think from a scheme-wise and what you see, it's a better game. There's more variety. There's more exciting plays. And, you know, the old days, if you didn't run the ball 40 times a game, you were a chicken. And that was the mark. Adam, the mark used to be run the ball 40 times, you win 75% of the time. That was the cliche amongst coaches. You got to run the ball. Now they run the ball maybe at most 30 times a game or 25 times a game. So the you see more, just more of everything. I often, when I'm asked this question, Adam, I say, in 1980, you could buy a Cadillac, and it was the most sophisticated car you could drive. You buy that same car in 2017, it is far more sophisticated, but it's called Cadillac. There's more technology in that car today than when they put the man in the moon, okay? And the football's the same way. And you as a coach have to grow. And the great thing about coaching, there are no secrets. You do it once and everybody else has it the next week. You know that. The game is expanded in what you see done with the ball and what you see within defensive schemes and special teams. I don't know how many times full, but many, many times.
How close did you come, Coach, to returning as a head coach from the period from 1983 to 96 while you were in the booth with that $100,000 salary that was more than you were making as a head coach?
Well, I would say, I'm not bragging when I say this, but
yeah.
13 out of the 14 years I was out, I had someone approach me and ask me if I was interested in being interviewed.
Wow.
And I had three direct offers to coach a team, two of them on the phone. One of them told me if I would take his job, I could write my own contract because he had so much money he couldn't spend it or his family could spend it in his lifetime, and he was tired of losing.
And were you tempted?
I thought about it, and I'll tell you exactly what happened, and this is the true story.
Yeah.
I was home at Christmas vacation visiting with my father, who only had weeks left to live with pancreatic cancer. And they found me at the home and talked to me on the phone. It was Hugh Culverhouse.
Wow.
And I told my dad, I said, Dad, you can't believe what just happened. I had Mr. Culverhouse just offer me an opportunity to come coach the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and I could write my own contract. And he said, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. And he said, Dick, do you need the aggravation? And I said, no. Then he said, don't do it. So I didn't do it.
Wow, but it would have been a blank check. See, and that's the biggest difference. When I get the privilege and honor of working with all these men who have coached in the game, I always tell them that they will not have the highs and lows that they did coaching, but they will lead a much more balanced, peaceful, stable life than they did as a coach. And you understand that as a former broadcaster and a former head coach, right? Like the broadcasting.
I understand that better. Especially when I went back in 97, I understood that.
Yeah.
I understood what John Wooden always told me. Your career and success are going to be determined by not how many games you win. Your success is going to be determined how you handle the adversity, the losses. And I learned that, and I hung on to that. In my first 2 years with the Rams were brutal. They were tough. But we got it done the old-fashioned way.
How did John Wooden tell you that? Did you meet with him? Did you seek out his counsel?
I was at UCLA. He was a UCLA guy.
That's right.
I knew John quite well. I learned an awful lot from him about the overall coaching principles and philosophies.
I forgot that you were there in UCLA in 74 and 75, and he's there. I forget that. You're on the campus.
I was also there in 70 as an assistant.
Oh, wow. What was the biggest takeaway you had from being around John Wooden?
Number one, don't worry about your competitors' talent. Just make sure those that you have, you're coaching to help them be the best they can be. And everything else will take care of itself. I think then number two was, like I just said, your success will be determined how you handle the adversity, not how you handle the wins. Because there's always going to be adversity. I'd say number three, stick by your beliefs. Don't second guess yourself if you believe in it. And don't compromise. Because as soon as you compromise the first time, there's going to be many more to come. And I could go on and on. But, I mean, those things stand up in my mind. And the overall team discipline is critical, you know. And I think the other thing John did a great job of, even though he was tough and a disciplinarian, the people knew he cared about him.
Yeah.
I really strive to make sure, even though I was tough and I was working on them, they were going out on strike and going up and see the president of the team through the back door, that I was doing it to help them become better, so I could get paid more.
I think your reputation always was that your players thought and knew that you cared about them.
And a part of that comes with your own personality.
Yep.
You know, I think John has that. I think he does. And I think he'll do it better than he did the first times around.
Who was the most influential figure in your football career, Coach? We bring up John Wooden there, but who really left a mark with you?
Well, they all did. You know, I worked for George Allen. I worked for Chuck Knox. I worked for John Ralston. I worked for Tommy Prothro. I worked with Bill Walsh, Jim Mora, these kind of guys. They all influenced me in a way that made positive contributions, you know. I don't know if anyone more than the other, but they just, you know, that was I was influenced by the studying of other coaches, Chuck Knoll. I hired Sid Gilman when he was 70 years old and then retired, and I learned tremendous amount of football from him. He was a great coach of coaches.
Yeah.
Great coach of coaches. Maybe one of the finest coach of coaches ever. And we became very good friends, and I learned a great deal. And not only did I learn, but all my offensive assistants learned as well.
Coach, when you watch today's game, who's the one coach that most impresses you?
Well, there's many that impress me. I'd say watching New Orleans offensively play, there is a reason Drew Brees is as good as he is. First off, he has the talent. Secondly, he's being coached by a great head football coach. He's impressive.
Every year their offense is right there, every year.
Yeah, there's a number. They all impress me. God, you know, I really admired Tom Coughlin, okay? Just admired him.
Yeah.
When he got fired, I invited him to spend a week in my training camp with me in his first year out. That's how much I respected him. Bill Parcells, I respected the hell out of him. You know, because I got to coach against him. And you learn a lot about guys you coach against. Tom Landry, to me, was probably the number one guy, the toughest to coach against for me.
How come?
You know, his teams were extremely well-disciplined, always very talented, very seldom ever gave away a football game. And you had to earn everything you got. You know, Joe Gibbs. In fact, Joe Gibbs got his very first win in his NFL career against my team, I think, when I was coaching against. But, you know, George Allen, God, you learn so much from these guys.
That's quite a list of people. And you mentioned being nervous for these guys, you know, meeting them. Was there one coach that you always remember being more nervous for when you had to go shake his hand or talk to him pregame?
Tom Landry and Don Shula.
Yeah.
You know, one time we beat Don Shula's team. In Philadelphia, it was a big win for us. Chuck Knoll was in that category, too. And after the game, Don said to me, he says, darn it, Dick, he says, how come your team always plays so well against mine? I says, Coach Hula, because you are the best. You bring out the best in your opponent.
That's
but
great.
Tom Landry, I was initially almost intimidated by him. I was nervous to go shake his hand, you know. About my second or third year in the league, Tom Landry signaled me in pregame warm-up. Now, this standing there with his sport coat and tie with his hat on, gave me the signal, hand signal, come on over. So I walked over, shook his hand. Hi, Coach. He says, you know, Coach, he says, you're doing a great job, but you're going to have to learn to relax some to stay in this game for a long time. It's exactly what he said to me.
And did you?
No. I didn't listen to anybody for a long time.
It takes a while to learn these things, right, Coach?
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of an insecurity, personally. Yeah.
You come back to that again, that insecurity part.
Yeah.
It's probably prevalent in a lot of these coaches and a lot of people in general. I think they're always fearful.
Losing my job. I was never afraid of losing my job. I was always afraid I wasn't doing a good enough job for the kids I was responsible for, the organization that was paying me. You know, I'm the only guy that's coached three teams in the NFL and never got fired.
Wow, that's an amazing stat, Coach.
Well, I take pride in it.
You should. That's very rare.
Great coaches today that want to talk about coaching, you know what I tell them? The first guy you coach is your owner. He has to know what, why, and how you're doing things.
Last bit of advice you give to today's coaches who are listening to this. I know you talked about your message before, but are there any other messages that you would deliver to coaches in general?
Well, the only thing you have total control of is your own personal preparation. You know, coaching in the league is different today, Adam. You know, now the players control the amount of time on the field, the amount of padded practices, what you do in the off season, and all that stuff. It's the Players Association, and there's some good will come out of it. Under these rules, I don't think we would have won a world championship in St. Louis.
How come?
Because the team that's been, they lost more games in the 90s prior to us taking it over in 97 than any teams in the league except the Jets. They beat out the Jets by one loss, okay? And you take over a losing team, and you can't work any harder on the field with your players than the teams that are already beating you. So you have to catch up within that same amount of time, and you have to draft better and luckier and all these kind of things. You know, it's just tougher. But in the old days, well, we didn't do well. We just stayed on the field longer so we could do it better with the people we had.
And now everything is restricted.
Everything's restricted.
Yeah.
And that was one reason I think John held out for so long.
He's not going to like these rules, Coach. He's not going to like those rules. I'm telling you that right now. I've heard him complain about it before.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what he's going to do. He will do as good or better a job than anybody in the league within the rules of today.
Yeah,
you know, Joe Gibbs was a friend, and I remember when I was in broadcasting and he was still coaching and rules were gradually changing. He says the only option I have is to do a better job within the rules as they are today. I can't change them. And I think John Gruden will do that.
So he's going to be a big success, Coach? He's going to be able to win a Super Bowl like you did a few seasons after he came back?
I think John Gruden will win a Super Bowl. Again, it takes the same thing to go to a Super Bowl and lose as it does to go there and win. That's why I deeply respect the teams that get there. And I don't feel as bad about losing like I did for a long time with the Eagles. Now, we went there in 5 years and had no first, second, or third round pick in 1976. We had no first, second, or third round pick in 1977. We had no first or second round pick in 78. But we had no limitation on how long we could stay on the field and how often we could wear pads to help our players get better. Today, you can't do that.
Yeah.
I didn't have any restrictions with the Rams. Now, they didn't like it, and they bitched and moaned about it, but they stayed with it. In 1997, my third year there, we backed off a little bit on him. still harder than everybody else was working, but it was so, it was different from how hard they'd been working that they appreciated it, and they responded well.
Well, Coach, I want to thank you very much for taking some time away from the wine business to provide us some perspective on what John Gruden faces. You've always been a model of class, and you were again today, and I thank you very much for all your time always.
Adam, send me your address, and I'll send you some Vermeer wine.
I'm going to do that. Yeah. My wife Please. Will appreciate that, Coach.
You like red and white?
You could send whatever you want. I'd be very, very thankful and very appreciative.
Send me your address. I'll get it to you right away.
Cap hit.
All right, we now bring in the NFL ESPN researcher on championship, conference championship weekend, Evan Kaplan. And Evan, thanks for joining us today. Much appreciated.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
Evan, we've got three 13-win teams on championship weekend. When is the last time we saw something like this?
That hasn't happened since the 2004 postseason. It's actually only the fifth time in NFL history that we have three 13-win teams on championship weekend. Obviously, some of these quarterbacks, Case Keenum, Nick Foles, don't have the historical pedigree, but these teams show during the regular season. You win 13 games and you kind of deserve to be on championship weekend.
Agreed. How about the Patriots? Look, we've heard a lot of talk about the fact that they are playing in their seventh straight conference championship game. How much significance do you put in the number seven here?
It's kind of interesting. The number seven in the 2017 season. So as you said, seventh straight conference championship game. They have won a playoff game in seven straight seasons. That's an NFL record. They've won seven straight home playoff games, and this will be the seventh AFC championship game that Tom Brady and Bill Belichick will play at home. To put that in perspective, there are five NFL franchises who haven't played seven home playoff games in any round.
Wow. That tells you something right there. And it we really also does. See this weekend, Tom Coughlin and the Patriots meet again, not the first time. What does it mean to you?
Obviously not the head coach in Jacksonville, but a major influence on that franchise. And we know about the two Super Bowls that the Giants beat the Patriots when Tom Coughlin was the head coach. He also won a road game in New England in the 2011 season. And if you look back since 2001, the Brady Belichick era, Tom Coughlin is the only head coach with three road or neutral site wins against the Patriots.
That's pretty amazing, right?
We'll see
there.
What he can do this week with the Jaguars.
Tom Coughlin's been the Patriots' kryptonite to a certain extent.
He has been.
Tom Brady right now, how would we put into perspective how much he has been throwing?
This is something interesting that Joey Roberts and I discussed on Sunday Countdown last week, that he is throwing the ball at a higher rate than any other quarterback in postseason history. He has thrown 251 passes in his last five playoff games. And our friends at Elias tell us that's the most by any quarterback in a five-game span in postseason history. And if you compare earlier in his career to since the 2014 postseason, his attempts per game are up by almost 12 per game. So the Patriots, despite his age, they're relying on Brady to throw the ball.
You know, it's interesting because I think somebody said over the weekend that Tom Brady has played the equivalent of an extra two full NFL seasons of just playoff games.
It's incredible.
That's Tom Brady. All right, we've got Case Keenum and Nick Foles going up against each other in the NFC Championship game. What strikes you about that matchup there?
We've heard a lot over the last few days about how much that they were teammates, obviously, with the Rams. But the most interesting thing to me is how they were acquired and when they were acquired. March 10th, 2015, the Rams traded for Nick Foles. Nick Foles went to the Rams. Sam Bradford went to the Eagles. There were also picks involved in that deal. The very next day, Case Keenum was traded to the Rams for a seventh-round pick. And now those two quarterbacks will be on the same field in Philadelphia for a right to go to the Super Bowl.
And the Vikings defense certainly has helped carry this team to this weekend's NFC Championship game in Philadelphia. How would you put into perspective what their defense has done there, Evan?
Look, the Jaguars have gotten a ton of attention for their defense, and deservedly so, and that's a major reason why they're playing the Patriots. But if you look across the board, the Vikings were the best defense this entire season. They led the NFL in scoring defense, in total defense, in third down defense. They're the first team to do that since the 2009 Jets, only the fourth team to do it in the last 15 years. And on third down, it's remarkable. They only allow teams to convert 25% on third down. That's the best percentage in the last 25 years. And if you look at the last four games going back to the regular season, it's just ridiculous. 8 for 49 teams are converting third downs against the Vikings. That's 16%.
Evan, thanks as always for all this information and perspective. Enjoy conference championship weekend.
Same to you, Adam.
Ask 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 Adam.
We should ask Adam.
All right, Adam. Some good questions after that always informative and entertaining cap hit segment. First question comes to us from Johnny G. Not Jimmy G, but Johnny G.
Big difference.
Big difference. Although, hey, who knows? Maybe Johnny G can spin it. And he does have a question about quarterbacks. Johnny wants to know if Case Keenum is going to get paid like a Minnesota legend, or is he going to be better suited following Pat Shurmur wherever his OC ends up going?
Well, look, let's assume that Pat Shurmur does wind up in New York, because I think that's what will happen. He'll wind up as the Giants coach. If that indeed is the case, then I don't think that Case Keenum finds his way to New York, because they have Eli Manning there and they can go draft a quarterback at number two. So it does not seem like a pressing match there in New York. And what I think happens is that Case Keenum basically, I think personally he's got a really good chance at staying in Minnesota under the franchise tag, to be honest with you. I think that's the most likely scenario right now, especially if they continue to go further and further in the postseason. But one way or another, Jimmy G, Johnny G, all the G's, Case Keenum's getting paid.
Yeah, no, he definitely is. Next question from Sleepy. Sleepy says, after seeing what Josh McDaniels did as a head coach in Denver his first time around, why is he such a hot commodity, Adam? He's a great coordinator, but his track record seems to show that he's not such a great head coach.
You know, it's funny. Me and Lewis Riddick and Ryan Clark had this debate on NFL Live on Monday, and Ryan Clark raised that same question to Lewis and I. And what I would tell you is this. Number one, there are any number of coaching candidates who go through an experience as a head coach and learn from it and are much, much better served the second time, a la Bill Belichick.
Right.
Okay, Mike Shanahan. We can go on and look at all the Super Bowl winning coaches, and I think many of them have won Super Bowls in their second stop as a head coach. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that there are not many overly effective, productive play callers in the league. And Josh McDaniels, you could say Tom Brady, fine, but he's done it with Jimmy Garoppolo. He's helped groom him. He's helped groom Jacoby Brissett. He's helped Tom Brady elevate his game. There are not many overly effective, productive play callers in this league. Josh McDaniels can do that. And he's been around that culture in New England for so long that when he goes, and most people believe he will wind up in Indianapolis, but when he goes after the season and does get his head coaching job, he's going to bring a culture with him. And I can tell you that there are multiple teams that are interested in that culture and what Josh McDaniels would bring. And I think those are some of the reasons that people are interested in him.
Josh McDaniels, of course, for now, still on the Patriots
for
coaching
now,
staff.
Right, he's going to leave.
Yes. Someone who already has left is Brian Daboll. And Darcy says, what are your thoughts on the Bills hiring Brian Daboll, former Patriots assistant, former Alabama offensive coordinator?
Yeah, left Alabama this past weekend, went to Buffalo, and you have to keep in mind here, Josh, that Brian Daboll is from the Buffalo area. His family is back in the Buffalo area. Brian Daboll loves the Buffalo area. Yeah, exactly. So this is a move that made a lot of sense on a lot of different levels. He did a great job down in Alabama calling plays for the Crimson Tide this year. We saw how that offense worked and functioned. Very effective. And I think Brian wanted to get back to the NFL and bring his knowledge there. And so he's going to do that in Bill Belichick's division in the AFC East for the Buffalo Bills. And I think he'll do a very good job for the Bills.
Do you think it's odd that he didn't wait until Josh McDaniels left to maybe once again take over as New England's OC?
I think that if the Buffalo Bills offensive coordinator job had not opened, that Brian Daboll would have gone with Josh McDaniels. But that was the one job in the one place with the one city with the one franchise that could have swayed him and prevented him from uniting with Josh McDaniels. If the Buffalo Bills OC job doesn't open, I believe Brian Daboll does go with Josh McDaniels.
So you think he would have gone with Josh McDaniels? You don't think he would have gone back to New England to once again serve as their offensive coordinator?
That's correct. I believe he would have been a assistant for Josh McDaniels, but the Buffalo offensive coordinator job was just too good to pass up.
Interesting. Next question from Brock Finch. Brock is at Finch Brock and has a really interesting question, Adam. Brock says, do you think the success of teams with a strong defense and, let's just be nice and say, non-elite quarterbacks changes teams' approaches to the draft and free agency moving forward?
No. I still think, I know this year is an unusual year, and I know that our final four quarterbacks are Nick Foles, Case Keenum, Blake Bortles, and Tom Brady. But look, Case Keenum's played at an MVP level. Nick Foles was sort of thrust into that position. They already had clinched home field advantage, or were on the verge of clinching home field advantage, right? So both NFC quarterbacks are different and, again, go against that theory that you're proposing. And Blake Bortles is playing on an elite defense in much the same way that Trent Dilfer did for a Baltimore Ravens team that won the Super Bowl back in 2000. So, no, I still think that quarterback is the most important position in all sports. I don't think this season changes the approach that front offices across the league are going to have. You still must have a quarterback to compete to get to the final level. And, yeah, look, we could see Case Keenum or Nick Foles or Blake Bortles as a Super Bowl champ this year. I got it. But, again, if you think that you can get by skimping at that position, I don't see it happening. This is an unusual year. I think these quarterbacks all have unusual circumstances, but to me, it doesn't change the approach that anybody has towards the quarterback position in the future.
Good to know. And next question is an interesting one from M. M is at J Madre. He wants your take on a name we haven't heard a lot about since the playoffs started, Jimmy Graham. M wants to know, where will Jimmy land next season? If not Seattle, what other teams do you think could be in the mix?
Well, Seattle's got a lot of cash issues there. And Jimmy Graham is a free agent. And I guess Seattle could always franchise him, but I don't think it will. He really came on this year and played very, very well. Played like the Jimmy Graham that we all knew back in New Orleans. My sense is he'll hit the market. He'll look around. And tight end has been one of those positions that's been tough to fill. A lot of teams looking for them. You'd have to see a team, find a team that has a lot of salary cap space and has a need at the tight end position.
Any chance at a reunion with Drew Brees down in New Orleans?
I don't think it's – listen, if we're up to Jimmy Graham, I think Jimmy Graham would like to have that happen.
Yeah.
But New Orleans is going to have some cap issues, and if they can make it work with him, I'm sure Jimmy Graham would love to have that happen.
And they have to worry about signing Drew Brees,
correct,
too, right?
That's correct. That's the first piece of the puzzle, yeah. Getting him back there. And they get him back there and they want to figure out a way to get Jimmy Graham, great. That would be a tremendous move for the Saints.
That could certainly complicate things. So I didn't mean to cut you off. It sounds like the answer to your question is most likely staying in Seattle?
No, I think most likely exploring the market.
Okay.
And moving on from Seattle, but I don't know where just yet.
Fair enough. Couple more here. This one from Jeremy York at the Impact 99. Adam, everyone always sees that very, very classy bookshelf that you have behind you when you're on TV. What are some of the books in that famous bookcase, and what are your favorite ones?
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm sitting here right now. I'm turning around to take a look. And, again, I grew up reading a lot of Mitch Albom. So mm-hmm. Tuesdays with Morrie and the Bo Schembechler book that he first read, I love that kind of stuff. Some of my favorite writers are up there on the wall, books I've read. Frank DeFord, before he passed away, was an unbelievable writer. Really loved his stuff. There's a book called The Imperfectionist that I really enjoyed reading, Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand. Ian McKeown is a great writer who wrote this book called Atonement. A lot of Thomas Friedman. I think he's just a brilliant mind. I wish he'd run for president. I would vote for him any day of the week.
You only have to vote for him on a Tuesday.
Yeah,
though,
a lot of books devoted to sports writers and great sports writers, because I spent so much time studying that growing up. Jim Murray and Lee Montville and Frank DeFord, like I said, and Rick Riley and many of the guests, Paul Zimmerman, the people that I grew up reading. Mm-hmm. And that meant a lot to me. So there's a lot of that, and there are some books that, again, caught my fancy. J.O. Moringer's a great writer, the Andre Agassi book, The Tender Bar, a lot of different things.
Very good. And finally, it was an Ask Adam tradition unlike any other. We got away from it.
A food question?
We got away from it. I'm glad it's back. Thanks to Nick Pastora. Nick says, chicken or beef in your tacos, Adam?
Oh, not even a question. Chicken.
Really?
And in a perfect world, shrimp would be the ideal choice over chicken and beef, Josh.
Wow.
But you're giving me chicken and beef, I'm going to go chicken.
I'm surprised there because, you know, typically people go with the ground beef, Adam.
Not me.
And so when you said it's not even a question, I figured you were going to, you know, just fall in line, but apparently not.
Yeah, but can we get shrimp in there instead of the ground beef or the chicken?
You'll have to ask Nick. I don't know.
If we could do that, I'd be very, very happy with Taco Tuesday.
Tweet back at us, Nick, and tweet at us everybody else. Use the hashtag AskAdam. Get those questions in, and we'll answer them next week on the podcast.
Thank you for the questions, everybody, and thank you to Paul Allen, the Minnesota Vikings play-by-play voice, Dick Vermeil, who once made the same transition that John Gruden is attempting to do right now, and Evan Kaplan for some added insight into this weekend's conference championship games. Hope everybody enjoys this weekend's games, and we'll see you back here in this spot next week.